very mundane things.
Because today we're supposed to be talking about what can we do in an overseas setting, and the thrust of it is in terms of the possibilities for lay ministry around the world. Now, before you start talking about something like that, you have to kind of bring people into line with what has been happening in World Mission. And therefore, for some of you, I may repeat just a little bit here. But the nature of world missions has changed considerably in the last 15, 20 years, because we're now in that era when at least a core of the Christian church is to be found in virtually every land in the world. And therefore, we have shifted from the thrust of being sending churches to peoples who have never heard the gospel to the idea of being sister churches who are cooperating with the Christians in any land for the proclamation of the gospel in that place. Now that seems like just a little shift, but it calls for major readjustment in a lot of our thinking, in a lot of our activity and organization. Because what we're saying is that we are no longer the great white fathers who are going out to the benighted heathen of other lands. We are rather God's people who, through the grace of Christ, have been given something that we want to share, and we want to do it by strengthening the Christians that are to be found in any land. And therefore, world mission has taken on the dimension of being God's people at work for the proclamation of his gospel in all six continents. And therefore, we, as much as they, are a mission field, because we realize that in places like in Africa, in Ghana, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Tanzania, you have a higher percentage of Christians than you do in many portions of our own United States. Upwards of 40 to 50% of some of those populations are now within the fellowship of the Christian Church. You go into New York City, into Detroit, into Los Angeles, and what have you got? Quite a different situation, you see. So when we talk about world mission, we are at that point where we're talking about the communion of saints throughout the world being concerned with the proclamation of God's great message for all people in every place. Well, some people hear that and they say, well, what does that do to world mission? To me, it makes it even more exciting than ever before, because it does not for a moment mean that we have finished our responsibility for reaching out. Let's get that very clear. If Christ is Lord and Savior, then we will be restless until that proclamation is made for all men. But I think what we're talking about here maybe is methodology. We go at it a little differently now, because of the fact that there are a nuclei of Christians in every place. And therefore, when we talk about what we can do, we talk about it in terms of our relationship with Christians around the world. Now, to get that down to more specific concerns, we generally in the church recognize that everyone cannot do everything. And therefore, we assign responsibilities, as they did in the early church, some to be stewards, some to be caretakers, some to be servants, some to be proclaimers, some, you know, the whole range within the Christian fellowship is in terms of people being called to specific tasks and duties. And therefore, within our Christian churches, we are organized in such a way that we have a board which is responsible to carry out this mandate of proclaiming the gospel in other lands, called the Board of World Missions. Incidentally, just to keep your terminology aboard, it's not the Board of Foreign Missions anywhere. We don't call it that anymore. There is no such thing as a foreign mission in God's eyes, but there is a mission to the world. These are boards of world missions, and their responsibility is to continually hold before us that worldwide responsibility, and then for us and on our behalf to be doing something about that action in the world. The three boards for world mission of the Lutheran churches, for example, have therefore entered into programs and operations overseas in certain specific areas, and we have channeled our efforts and our work through them. We are now at the point where generally we operate through that Board for World Mission with specific churches around the world and enter into relationship with them for personnel, for finances, for the activity of proclaiming the gospel. It means that in our day and age, when these churches have become largely indigenous, that means these churches have raised up from within their Christian groups leaders who are now in charge of the planning and the operation of the church. They invite us to send missionaries to work in and under that church. And so the probably the greatest change in terms of our church relationship is that we no longer sit in Minneapolis or St. Louis or New York and decide this year we're going to send 50 missionaries to Japan. No, we enter into relationship with the Lutheran churches in Japan and say, what do you need that perhaps we can fill? And it is therefore only by invitation that missionaries are now called to serve in these churches around the world. Now, immediately that raises a question in our mind. For example, in Japan, where we worked for 12 years, the total Christian population is still less than 1%. Can we be satisfied that we have fulfilled our missionary mandate, our mission mandate, when we relate only to the Lutheran Church in Japan, when we see that perhaps they are not active enough in trying to reach the other 99%? That's the struggle that we're living in our day and age. Are we limited, in other words, to this new cooperative relationship with our overseas sister churches, or is that one of the avenues and we must be about finding other avenues as well? I'm going to leave that one right where it is, and if it interests you, we can talk about it later. But this is one of the problems that's plaguing the Lutheran churches now. Granted, we have limited resources. We have, you know, the two principal resources that we have are personnel and finances. And if you spread personnel or finances too thin, you of course don't accomplish anything. If you concentrate them in cooperation with the Christians in a given land, perhaps you can accomplish something. But all of this is intended to bring you simply up to date to the fact that we live in a different kind of an age where we are working primarily through Christian churches in another land, and this primarily at their invitation rather than our decision. Now, with that frame of reference, what in the world is going on? Well, obviously, the major change that is taking place is that the role of the missionary has changed. You know, in the early years, when we sent missionaries out, they were pioneers. They went into an area, there were, in many, many places in the pioneer days, there were no Christians at all. They went in and initially proclaimed the gospel in that place, gathered a group of people who then responded to that gospel, formed a church, and began the whole operation. The missionaries carried the whole load. They were the preachers, they were the teachers, they were the organizers, they were the pastors. Everything depended on the missionary. And in our very human way of looking at things, you know, that builds up a certain prestige, a certain authority, and missionaries are very much human. They found it sometimes difficult to give up those positions to the nationals that were rising up under them. And therefore, in God's providence, in many places around the world, the missionary terms were shortened by all kinds of national developments, by international wars, by all sorts of things that helped the missionary realize that he should be living according to the dictum that he is trying to work himself out of a job. Because the primary thing about a missionary is that he's going there to plant, to nurture, and then let God give the increase, and let those people in turn then become the Christians in that place. But that first stage was nevertheless very, very important. A pioneer missionary who went out to proclaim the gospel that the church may be planted. Well, as the church grew, the evolution of his role began to change.
And he moved away from being the pioneer evangelist to being the supervisor of the evangelists and the pastors in that place. And again, this was very natural. He was far more educated than the people. He had a longer history and tradition in the Christian faith. He had the resources of a mission board behind him. It was very natural that the second stage should be that of supervisor. But as the national churches began to grow, and as nations became more and more independent, that role of the missionary also changed to that of co-laborer, a partner in the churches. And for many, many years, for example, the Presbyterian Methodist churches never called their people missionaries. They said they're fraternal workers who are going out to work alongside of the national pastors and evangelists and so forth. And this was a healthy development. As you move along, though, you soon discover that the expatriate person simply doesn't have the resources usually, the cultural adaptation and so forth, and therefore, little by little, the national pastors and evangelists naturally rise to positions of leadership, and the role of the missionary then becomes that of an enabler or a servant to the church. And that's the point at which we're really at right now. When we train new missionaries, as we do in our Inner Lutheran Training Committee each summer, we hammer home the idea that you're going as a servant of those people. You're not going as a big boss, as a supervisor, as a director. You're going to serve people. The servant role is really that which the missionary in our day must take. And if you can comprehend that in terms of the Christian faith and life, it can be a tremendously exhilarating role that you're going there to undergird, to enable, to support, that the group of Christians in any given land may grow and be strong. And if someone wants to go out now without taking on that servant role, we have a very difficult time approving him for missionary work. All right. The servant role, you know, for many missionaries, of course, that has always been the role. And whenever I use categories like this and define them, you know, it's a generalization. And in any given place and with any given person, you have to make the adjustment. I know some people who are still working like pioneer missionaries. And rightly so, because in a given country, in a given area of that country, they are reaching out into areas where the gospel has not yet been proclaimed. And they must very much act the part of a pioneer evangelist. But generally speaking, that role has now become a part of the history of the church and is not the primary role of the missionaries. If that's the case, if we respond to the call of a national church, if we send people to fill the positions which are determined by a national church, what kind of people ought we be looking for? In order to answer that question, I was asked by the three Lutheran churches in the States to visit 25 of the areas in the world where we are sending people. It was for me, you know, one of the grandest global tours that you could ever imagine, because it meant covering all of Africa and the Near East and Asia and the Far East. I was going to South America as part of it, but we ran into a little revolution down there and it was postponed, and sometime next January I expect to be going down there. But the purpose for that visit was to ask the national church leaders, when you want a worker, what kind of a person are you looking for? The overwhelming desire of these people was expressed in the number one point: send us mature Christians. We don't want people who are coming over here to live an exotic life or to find new and interesting people or to study our culture or to maybe put their own head together. If you send us someone that is searching for his own faith, then he is not only of no help for us, but chances are he will only become confused and bewildered himself. Don't send us people that are looking for their faith. Send us those who have a strong faith in Jesus Christ and want to share that with others. The overwhelming desire, and this springs out of some very unfortunate experiences, was that the national church leaders said, don't send us someone who who needs ministry, send us someone who can minister to us. Along with that, and a strong second, send us people who are culturally adaptable. And that means not simply being able to tolerate living in another country, but getting to the point of really enjoying it, of really appreciating the art and the culture that we have here. And then to live as a Christian within that culture, and if judgment on our culture comes, fine and good. But don't come condemning our culture before you even know us. And please send us people who have the capacity to live within another frame of reference. And what they did not say, but what was very apparent in that, was that they were asking us not to send people who brought all their own cultural baggage with them. And that's one of the hardest things that we have to do in our summer missionary training program, is to make people realize that every one of us carries a cultural baggage with us that is not Christian, but because we come from a, quote, Christian nation, many Americans confuse the American way of life and the Christian life. And we have to divest them of that idea. Now, the minute you say that, people raise their hand and say, now, wait a minute. You're sending a person over there. That person is a product of this culture. If they're going to be honest people, they have to admit that culture too. Great. We're not trying to destroy the American culture any more than we're trying to destroy another. But we're trying to make people sensitive to the fact that we are shaped by our culture, for good or for ill. The people where they're going are shaped by their culture, and you have to be sensitive to the fact that here is an encounter between cultures, but as a guest of another country, you are primarily responsible to be sensitive to that culture. And maybe you can do that only by knowing your own very well. So, culturally adaptable people. Third point was sensitive and loving people. Now, you know, what does that really mean? Well, different people had different ways of expressing that. But what they were really driving at was a person who could come and be open to people so that he didn't come with an oppressive kind of an approach or attitude, did not come with all the answers, but came willing to listen, to really hear what people were saying in another culture, really able to attune himself to their needs, and then through it all to overflow with the kind of love that Christ has for people. That's asking an awful lot of a person, you know. When you start looking at these expectations, boy, how many of us really measure up to them? A mature Christian, able to share his spiritual life, culturally adaptable, able to enjoy another culture, sensitive and loving. But what they were saying to us is that, you know, we want your best. We need people who can really help us. And the kind of people that we think can help us have some of these qualities and characteristics. The fourth one, of course, was the ability to teach. And again, how many of us know that? You finish a teacher's training course. You finish with your college degree. You go out to that school here in the States within your own culture. You don't even know if you can really be a teacher. I mean, in the deeper sense of the word. How do you know whether a person is going to go from this culture to another and be a teacher? It's almost an impossible question. But we're beginning to get certain guidelines, certain almost intuitive measures whereby we can sense whether a person is going to be able to do that. Well, those are the demands that they set up for us, and that means that we have to screen our people pretty carefully, because right now in the American scene, we have a great number of people who are willing to go to another culture. You know, one of my responsibilities with the Lutheran Council is to call together the three personnel secretaries of the three boards of world mission from the ALC, LCA, and Missouri Synod. And we sit down about three times a year and talk over this whole range of personnel possibilities and needs and potentials and so forth. And I discovered last April at our meeting that these three men get over 2,000 inquiries a year about working overseas. Now, what do you do when you get 2,000 inquiries? You can't possibly go and interview every one of them. And so if any of you have or will send in a letter to one of the men that I've written on the board, here we go, that's going to be my commercial. I've got their names and addresses listed here. If you write a letter to them and say, I'm interested in world mission, I'm interested in serving overseas, will you indicate, you know, what the possibilities are? Chances are you're going to get a mimeograph letter. And that turns off a lot of people. They say, here I am, ready to be a missionary, and I get a mimeograph letter back. Well, just remember, there are 2,000 others that had the same idea. And if they were to take the time to write you a very personal, warm letter, just because you're interested, they'd spend all of their time doing that. What they're really trying to do is to sort out those who are seriously interested in being the kind of a missionary today that has meaning, or whether you just want a 2-year stint overseas at the expense of the church. And let's not kid ourselves. A whole host of people want a free ride overseas nowadays. And they're willing to put in a couple years someplace in order to get that. The church is not really interested in that kind of a person. Even though we've had some wonderful experiences with that kind of a person. What I'm trying to say is that with the abundance of volunteers for overseas service now, the churches have to be very careful that they select the right kind. And that selection process takes a long time. It takes up to a year because it involves personal interviews, involves checking with your background and your work here in the States. We have a hard time believing that a person is very sincere about converting people in China if he has done absolutely nothing in the States about the people around him, you see. Now, again, don't take that as a check-off. Because you haven't any record of work in the church. But it's one of the indications that we use. There is a psychological testing, there is medical testing, and again, an interview with the board. Why? Because the church invests a tremendous amount of money and time and risk in every person that they send overseas. And they want to try to, as far as possible, respond to God's calling to a person and the calling of a church overseas with the right kind of a person to do the job. So if you or if you know of anyone that has been initially kind of turned off because they said, hey, I want to go and nobody answers me, remind them of the fact that the church has to do this very carefully, very responsibly, among the thousands who are willing, at least verbally, to take up that kind of responsibility. Now, what kind of possibilities are there? Well, there are about 5 categories that I can think of for both lay and clergy in world service. One is the regular missionary role. And remember, that regular missionary role now involves cooperative effort with another church. For those who go as regular missionaries, the church underwrites their total expense and provides salary for them. We have another category called volunteers. All right, excuse me, the second category is short-term. Teachers, doctors, nurses, specialized personnel, short-term specialists. Here again, the church undergirds and underwrites all the expenses. A third category is that of volunteers. We have, through the World Brotherhood Exchange, now called Volunteer Services, sent over 500 people to different parts of the world on a volunteer basis, meaning that they usually provide their own transportation over and back. And we give them board and room and a stipend while they're working. They go to fill a specified position for a specified period of time, anywhere from 3 months to 2 years, and then return home. Their primary job is to provide a specific assistance, either to relieve someone else who comes home on furlough, or to fill in a specialized area where we don't have people on the field who can do that. So the volunteers have a very important role. Another category is that of the expatriate American. I'm going to review these for you in just a minute. But we have thousands and thousands of Christians from the United States who live and work overseas in other capacities. They are businessmen, they're embassy personnel, they're teachers, they're all kinds of people who, as Christians, ought to see that as a possibility for witnessing and ministering to the people in the country where they work. I think the State Department listed over 2 million Americans that are permanently or semi-permanently living overseas. Think of the tremendous mission force if we could muster that kind of a lay army to be Christians and to be living and witnessing as Christians in the countries around the world where they are. A tremendous untapped force. And we're working hard to try to do something about it, but it's extremely difficult. A final category that I would put in here is a tent-making ministry. And that, I think, is what may appeal to a lot of the young people today. We have volunteers, for example, that go to Japan, who go over on their own, who teach English in factories, in banks, in commercial centers, in schools, wherever they are requested. They earn money for that teaching, they pool that money, and through that resource, enable all of the people that are in that particular volunteer agency to live and to serve in that country. There are all kinds of possibilities that we haven't even begun to tap in terms of people who have an ability to earn their own way while in another country, while being Christian witnesses. There are countries where if you say you are a Christian missionary, you are verboten. You cannot enter. But if you come as an agriculturalist, willing to help with well digging, willing to help with the improvement of crops, they welcome you with open arms. Then, if you are a Christian, you have the possibility at that point of making your witness. So, regular missionaries, short-term specialists, volunteers, expatriates living overseas, and tent-making ministries. There are at least five of the possibilities, and I'm sure there are more. But through all of this, I hope you realize that what I'm trying to say is that if we are Christians, if we have learned something of the love of God and want to share that with others, there are possibilities of doing it throughout the whole world. And if one avenue may close to you, maybe another one can open up. If you can help someone else to see some of these possibilities, then you can send someone by proxy to carry on the work. The Christian mission is not over. The fact that many of them are retiring, many are being locked out of countries, many of the boards are being cut back in their funds, does not for a minute mean that the mission of Jesus Christ is over. And we simply have to find the means, the channels, to continue that work until the day of his coming. Okay, that's enough for a starter. Any questions or reactions or comments? Got one right here.
Could I say something? I don't know if the ALC is still doing this, but you were talking about the cultural, we should not take our culture with us and so on. The way the ALC at least was working the program when I went down to Brazil is that we were sent directly down to the field, no orientation here. Now I know the LCA and other churches were orienting their people here, but the cultural shock is incredible. You can go down in 8 hours and step off a plane, and here you are in a new culture, not knowing the language. And you have to hold on to something, or you just go out of your mind, something of your own culture. Mm-hmm. Now, we weren't even told what kind of clothes to bring, you know. For instance, you think of Brazil as being beautiful, colored, you know, colored clothes. I went out and bought all these beautiful colored shirts and things. You get down there, men wear black colors, black and white down there. You don't wear colored things. Women wear colored things. But you just don't go, you know, throw all your clothes away and go out and buy Brazilian stuff because it was very expensive and very poor in quality, and it wouldn't last for you. So you have all your American clothes that you've bought, and you're stuck with those, and they spot you right away as an American because your shoes immediately, your shoes are good. American, they can spot Americans right away because their shoes are good. Brazilian shoes are terrible. And so to a certain extent, you know, you have to maintain some of your culture while you're going through this tremendous cultural shock that you go through and that you don't, you know, people don't realize. And I would hope that they've changed that, that at least they send people for some orientation here before they send them right down.
Letting them go on so that I can move in. The reason I did not return to Japan in 1969 is that after 5 years of negotiation, the ALC, the LCA, and the Missouri Synod came together for what is called a Lutheran Missionary Training Committee. I was asked to be director of that, and for 6 years now, we have conducted just the kind of orientation training programs that you asked for. We take the missionaries, the new missionaries from the three churches, put them together for 7 weeks of intensive morning, noon, and night orientation in personal adjustment, in cross-cultural adjustment, in skill training, in area studies, in mission theology, in those things that they need to work through before they get there, and we culminate it with a week and a half, if possible, or at least a week, in which a furloughing missionary or two from a country live with that person in that training program. Eat with them, walk with them, talk with them. They're there, you know, so that by the end of the week, they have a realistic picture of what to expect when they get there. That's a very important thing. I ran into the same thing, and that's why I took this position. We were called to Japan, and we were told that there would be, you know, adequate time for some kind of reading and preparation and so forth. I was given some books to read, and then I was informed that the ship that we had booked passage on was canceled, and then we were going to fly. So in a very real way, I had the same experience. Within a matter of 17 hours, I was there. I couldn't say a word. I didn't know what the story was, and it was really quite a jolt. And many of the other missionaries that had gone through it had forgotten what they went through. You know, it was kind of like a sink or swim. Once you've learned to swim, it's no great threat to jump in the water. But if you don't know how to swim, it's very much of a threat. Well, because of that experience, I started writing and talking to people, and I suppose I got where I did as a result of that. But no, business firms, embassy people, practically everyone else, it's a very realistic orientation, and we in the church were one of the last to come to it. Lutheran Church Missouri Synod was way ahead of us. Bill Danker was running a missionary training program for years before we got around to this. Interestingly enough, I was asked to serve on the Missionary Orientation Center of the National Council of Churches in New York, where in the early or late 50s, they built a tremendous training center at Stony Point, New York. And they have trained hundreds and hundreds of missionaries there in a six-month program. But as funds became tight, as our relationship with overseas churches changed, that program folded. It's no longer in existence. Our Lutheran Missionary Training Program is one of two major missionary training programs left in the United States. The other is the Southern Baptist.
So what do they do when they get there, like Korea or China? What do you do in, you know, you send missionaries over there?
Yeah.
Are they to establish churches, or are they to teach the gospel?
Did you miss the first part?
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Can I talk to you about that? Unless the others want that to run through again. We've kind of talked about what they're doing. And,
you know, I was just wondering, because here in America, we're not a Christian nation.
Right.
And I don't see any outgrowing, really outreaching Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do kind of believe that we have to bring our own house in order.
The question is whether you wait to do something else until you bring that house in order. I think we have to be doing both at the same time. I think we have to be very concerned about our own and at the same time be reaching out to others. Now, I think in our day and age, in what we call the mission on six continents, we can be tremendously helped if we will allow some of them to speak to us. We've had some African and Asian church leaders that have come here to the States, have taken a good look at our society, and bring us some tremendous insights into what it means to live the gospel in our day and age. And we need that. We're a mission field, absolutely. So it's this wonderful exchange, though. It's really the exciting realization of the communion of saints, where we can share with each other, and we need it as much as they do. So we're very much in the age of mission on six continents. And if we can't receive, then maybe we ought not to be called on to share either. Yeah.
If we start out in America as a missionary, maybe basically I think we will start out as a missionary first in America in what I call internal and external affair. So we should start out here first, work with Indian, black. You have a problem. And like Appalachian, you have a problem. It's the best way to start out working experience first, before you go out with the world. And
Are you talking about a single person now, or are you talking about the work of the church?
A
single person. Uh-huh. Meaning that, for example, if we want to send somebody to Japan, that they ought to have an apprenticeship working among the Navajo Indians for a period of time, and then go to Japan. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
We've experimented with that a little bit, and we found that it's kind of self-defeating. Why? Because when you have made the necessary adjustment to living and working among the Navajo Indians to the point where you're really effective, then you go to Japan and there's virtually no carryover. You have to start all over again learning to adjust to live among the Japanese. The only possible carryover is the realization that you have to make that adjustment. And what we're saying in our training program is that we're trying to get that realization across without spending 2 years making one adjustment and then coming back and making another one, you see. I see your point, and it's very valid. In fact, the first year that we ran this missionary training program, we ran it in the heart of Chicago, where we were living day after day in the turf between the Blackstone Rangers and the Young Lords. And there were rumbles and things going on all the time. We had the Black Panthers harassing us and lecturing to us and everything else, and we had all kinds of experiences. And many of the people said, for the first time in my life, I know what it's like to live in fear. And then they went from that to Africa and Asia and so forth, and a year later, I made a point of writing to them. Now, did that Chicago experience really prepare you or help you in any way? And the almost unanimous answer was no. I adjusted to Chicago when I was there, but I got out here, and if I tried the same method of adjustment here, I would have been in real trouble. Because the blacks of Chicago are not the blacks of Liberia or Tanzania, you see. And therefore, we made an adjustment. We train them now in a beautiful ecumenical center in Madison, Wisconsin. It's a Roman Catholic center. Because we realize that to pull them apart and to try to work through certain things and then send them out with the idea that the first thing they have to do is listen and learn, that we're farther ahead than if we put them through an adjustment program here to some other group. Now, that's debatable, you know. I may be challenged on that. This man.
So these people that want to go out as missionaries, don't they prepare themselves in the language of the country they're going to before they go?
No. This is also a debatable item, but we have found that it is much more realistic to train them in the language when they are in the country. Why? Because it's not just classroom language. You're in the classroom for 4, 6, 8 hours a day. But when you get out and get on the streetcar or start walking home, you've got to use that language. You can't revert to English and hop on the subway in the States, you see. When you go to buy your food, you've got to use the language. When you go to, you know, exchange currency, you've got to use the language. It's a living laboratory. And we find that they not only learn the language better, the colloquial use of it, but they learn it faster. It's a terrifying experience, though, for a few months.
Well, some of the missionaries have been over there and served a certain length of time. Can't they come back here and teach the conversational language?
The worst thing to do is to learn language from a missionary. You've got to learn it from a national, or you aren't learning the language. What we do in our mission training program is to teach them how to learn a language. We have a course in linguistics, which prepares people for that ordeal. And believe me, it's an ordeal. You get people, you know, that have had experience here and finish their educational work and then get experience, because that's the kind of people we're looking for now. We take very few people directly out of college or seminary. We try to get them those who have proven themselves in their profession. All right, they're 25, 30, 35 years old, and all of a sudden they're hit with a language. They're sitting in a classroom, they can't even speak the language like the little kids running around them. It's a very humiliating experience, and that's what we have to get them ready for. If their attitude is right, then they can learn the language relatively faster. Well, you went to Campinas. What was your experience in this language?
In the language thing? I would have appreciated a little orientation with language here before,
yeah,
I went. Because it's just too big a shock all at once being thrown into it. So I would have appreciated at least a 2 or 3 week thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think learning the language on the field is really, the best thing. Once you are prepared for the cultural difference and shock. I think Dick Wangen from Lutheran World Federation came up to University of Minnesota and was teaching some Portuguese to some guys who were going up the mission field before. So we had a little orientation in there.
I didn't mean, you know, to block out any language. Learning how to greet people and get around and things like that, that's okay. But to really grasp the language, I think you have to do it there.
How long does it take to learn the language, and do you learn just to speak it and talk it, or how about writing it or reading it?
Well, that varies tremendously. One of my classmates from the seminary went to Africa, wrote me a joyous letter after 6 months and said, "I'm preaching in Swahili." I couldn't even say how much is a loaf of bread in Japanese yet. The languages of the world are so radically different that every country has its own time schedule. In Japan now, we don't let anyone get out and do any work with less than 2 years of Japanese. And we say, after your 10th year, maybe you can master the language.
One of the quick ways to learn a language is through your children. If you have young children, they pick it up so fast, it's unbelievable. They go out in the streets and they're rattling it off, and you listen to them and you learn. It's really
many a missionary has come downtown in another country and they hear something and they say, "Junior, what did he say?" "Well, Dad," we had a fellow in Japan, Lars Ingelsrud, that recognized his daughter's language ability, and after he was there for 3 years, he just about gave up on the language. But she had gotten it to the point where when he went out on a preaching mission, he would take her along, prop her up on a high stool beside himself, he'd preach in English, she'd say it in Japanese. It was a delightful little combination.
I've seen slides of that. She's a little blonde girl, too, and the Japanese were just so fascinated by her, by the blonde hair.
Yeah.
And she drew more people,
right?
And they did a little puppet thing or something, you know. And that really sold in Japanese.
Yeah. Somebody in Dustos, I don't remember who he was, now he came from Norway in Sweden, and he said that he found, when he came over, he didn't know English. But he says he found the best way was sitting on the back porch of the home where he was and talking to the children. But they'd act out everything. If he couldn't understand it, they'd act it out or talk with their hands and everything else. And he said he learned much more that way than he did in the other way.
In line with what I was saying earlier, too, you know, about the different roles of the people, right now, 70% of the people we send out are lay people. And that means that they are quite often going into specific lines of work. A medical doctor, for example, learns the language that is applicable to medicine. An agriculturalist to the work that he is in. A teacher to the profession that he or she is in. If you're going out as a pastor, as an evangelist, then of course you learn primarily that language. So it depends a lot on where you're going, what you're going to be doing, and what your own linguistic abilities are. But one thing all have to be prepared for, and that is to be reduced to a little child again. To speak like a little child for many months before you build up your vocabulary and become an adult again. Very tough for a lot of people. I've seen PhDs in Japan weep because they couldn't get that language.
Most people would, you know, is your idea of what the mission is, like, your idea now, as far as the people that are following the mission is that, you know what I mean? Is
Am
the
I,
concept of the world mission instead of foreign mission, and the concept of that we can learn from the mission of other countries here, and the idea that we're going in as servants, like the general accepted.
I can say without hesitation that that's the generally accepted idea among Lutheran world mission people. Yeah. Right. And again, making adjustment for certain countries. For example, we just went into Central African Republic with the ALC. We went in because there were a few Christians there that invited us in. But the people that go in cannot count on that Christian community as providing teachers and evangelists. For the first few years, the people we send there have to be very much the pioneer evangelist. But when we send people to Japan now, we send them according to the wishes of the Japan Lutheran Church. Yeah.
Do you always then wait for an invitation?
Well, they, again, as I said earlier, this is the big problem that's really haunting us. When we enter into a relationship with a church, a sister church, we say, yes, we will not work here except by your invitation or in consultation with you. In other words, if we see in Japan, just as an example, if up in the northern island of Hokkaido, we see that the church is really not doing anything, that they are not receiving there the Word of God, then we sit down with the Japan church and say, you know, that's a burden for us. You would, you know, can we work it out with you so that we can start work there? If they say no, then we reserve the right, you know, as God's people to say, but that is an area we have to go. We haven't run across that yet, I must say. But I think in our planning, whenever we're in consultation with the church, we enter into an agreement and say we will work in and through this church, but we reserve the right under God to carry out what we think is our mandate if we do not feel that it's being carried out.
I was just wondering, in your second category, you said the short-term expert. How do you manage this with the language problem?
The short-term specialist is quite often placed in a setting where the language does not become the primary problem. In other words, for example, short-term teachers to New Guinea, we send an awful lot of them. Why? Because they can teach for 2 years in English, and the language adjustment is no great problem. We try to get them to learn Pidgin English, of course, you know, because it helps. But their primary teaching is in English. You send a doctor to Liberia, he can use the English language primarily because there are enough people that can work with him. When it's a short period, we don't think that a great language study is necessary because we would rather work through an interpreter. In Japan, when we send short-termers for 2 years, we do give them 6 months of language just so that they're able to get around. But then the rest of the time, it's usually using their English language. So here again, you know, I can make a general category, and then I have to say, but when you're talking about Liberia or Tanzania or Madagascar, here's the way we do it, you see.
Is that 6 months dead time, or non-functional, or is that in conjunction with...
Like in Japan?
Yeah.
No, we have such a tremendous demand for English in Japan that a person can start an English class the day after they arrive, you know. So that while they're studying the Japanese language, most often they are also conducting an English class, an English Bible class, or something like that. Because that's a part of the learning process, too.
Now, I have an experience with a Japanese fellow. He seemed to have broken English somewhere in high school. It's like a limit, and you have to have Japanese. You cannot have too much, just chop off. And somehow, he could not speak other languages like European, German speaking, and he only speak English. That's all.
Yeah.
And he spoke, she spoke very slowly, more slowly. Not like this, people talk so fast. It takes time, effort to do this.
Right.
And I noticed that. That's why it's difficult language, you know, it's just chop off.
Yeah. The Japanese, since World War II, of course, have made English mandatory in their educational system. And most Japanese will have 8 years of English by the time they finish high school. However, that 8 years of English have been in a Japanese classroom from a Japanese teacher, with a result that they can read and write. But when it comes to conversation, they just have a terrible time. And that's why the demand for English teachers is so great in Japan. They have the foundation in reading and writing, but they want someone to talk to so that they get the conversation in English. Yeah,
I've had friends who visited Japan and said that the Japanese people would just stop in the street to converse with them because they wanted to talk to them.
Haro, can I speak English with you? Yeah. Yes.
We had a couple at Auschwitz who came back from Japan, and I was quite disappointed. They were a beautiful couple, very beautiful couple, but I got the understanding that the English, the the Japanese officially to learn, you know, for the Americans have all the opportunities and don't care. But they would go just to learn the language, you know, to the missionaries. And I heard, the witness that I heard was about how wonderful Japanese people are and the wonderful part of their culture, but I never heard how many souls were won for the Lord. And if we don't do that, I mean, just to teach them English or teach, you know, bring some of our culture, then we lost our mission.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah, I'm sorry to that you heard that part of it, because usually English is simply a vehicle for establishing relationship with these people. For example, I was in student work for 5 years. Our student center was right across from Tokyo University, the most prestigious in the nation. I had, you know, hundreds of kids that were interested in English. And when they come to the student center, I'd say, certainly, I'll teach you English. But that isn't really why I'm here. I'm here to share something far more important than English. So if you want to learn a little English, I'll spend an hour with you. And then I'll invite you to our Bible class, where what I really want to teach you is going to be said. And invariably, they would come to the English hour, to the English hour, and then I would make a break. I really made this very clear, that I wasn't using English as a leverage to force them into a Bible class. But at 1 hour I would have English, at another hour I would have Bible study. But invariably they came from one to the other, because they sensed that because I was willing to teach English, they had some kind of an obligation. Well, that was a hard one to handle, you know, so that we didn't make, as I said yesterday, rice Christians out of them. People who become Christian only because you keep handing them things. But I tried to make it very clear. English is a service that I offer, but it's not really what I came here to do. Our time is up. Let me...